Okay, I think we will get started. In the interest of fair warning, this isn't exactly a concert. It's a class, so there'll be a lot more talk. If it was a concert, I would follow the advice of my wife, who is my best critic. Best friend, best critic, and she always says, more music and less talk. Yeah. She says that around the house, too, but that's a different one. But I get to talk as much as I want to because it's a class. Get things rolling, I'm going to start with something a little different. In a concert, you want to play something kind of flashy. But this isn't. It's a blues, and it's called How Long Blues. Okay, I see they closed the doors. I hope they're still going to let people in. Or maybe that's to keep you guys in. I think that's it. All right. That was the How Long Blues, and that is a good way for me to warm up sometimes and just try to calm, center. we're going to talk some more about ragtime today and blues as well. And I think just to get the ragtime discussion going, I'll play a piece here, not by Scott Joplin, but one of his admirers and kind of a contemporary. He's about 20 years younger than Joplin, but he was a great admirer of Joplin's. And he's interesting because he wasn't African American, but he, in fact, he was an Irish guy, and he was from New Jersey. And he just, but he just loved Joplin's music, and in fact became one of the great composers of this kind of formalized ragtime that Joplin was the father of. And his name was Joe Lamb. And this is one of his pieces. It's called Cottontail.
Thank you.
you very much. We were talking about this in the first class, and if you missed that, don't worry. You don't have to know anything from that. Maybe I could give you the entire lecture word for word, but in fact, they record this stuff. I would assume you could hear it someday when it's issued on Sony or whatever. No. This is a class kind of thing. We're going to talk about how the music is, the structure of it, basically. And the main thing about all of this stuff that I'm working on here is the rhythm, and we talked about that a bit the other day, in fact, too. That really is the basis of all of it. And then the right hand, the left hand is doing all this strong rhythm. And the right hand, the ragtime's a perfect illustration of this, but it's a principle of just about all of African-American music. You've got this strong rhythm, and then you're playing against that. And ragtime, it's simple, because the left hand, at least most of the time, is doing keeping the time, doing that rhythm, getting that snap into it. And the right hand is playing against that with accents in unexpected but interesting places. It's called syncopation. And you don't have to know anything about music to understand syncopation. You don't even have to know the word to understand it. It's something you just feel. But I can illustrate it for you by taking the first theme of a tune that some of you guys have probably heard quite often, and because it was at the top of the popular music charts back in the 70s, 1974, 75, when it was almost like a theme song for a film called The Sting. And its original title, Joplin's title, was The Entertainer. And I think I can show you what syncopation is by playing it with the syncopation. The first theme, and then playing it without the syncopation, and I think you'll get the idea. Square, I guess. So there you have it. That's all you need to know about ragtime. No, it isn't. But I want to go to the blues next because I think that's really pretty much the main part of this particular class, this session. What I just played there was How Long Blues, and I kind of based that on the playing of one of my favorite players, Jimmy Yancey, whom I've mentioned before if you were here last time. Yancey was from Chicago. He was a boy wonder in the entertainment business, actually, born about the turn of the 20th century. You used to think it was 1898, but it's not, because they found his World War I draft card, probably 1900. And he, as a young boy, pre-teens, he was on the road in vaudeville kind of shows with his father, who was in a traveling troupe of entertainers, and they ranged far and wide. Yancey was not playing the piano for this. He was a kid. He was a dancer and a little singing, too, but mostly he was a dancer, and this was not unusual to have kids in these traveling troupes of entertainers. They got as far as Europe, and he was still in his preteens, and And he found some documents that show that he at least applied for a passport while he was in England because he wanted to go on this tour in Russia, and he probably ended up in Russia. And that was the year there was, I think it made him around, you know, less than 15 years old, maybe 12, 13 years old when he was doing this, traveling around the world. Nobody's sure exactly when he started playing piano, but he was completely self-taught. And he was the kind of guy who squeezed the most music out of the fewest notes. I just want to play another blues here just to keep you interested, because I'm already talking too much. I can see that. But I know. Let's see. This next one is called the Gulf Coast Blues. It's a composer is Clarence Williams, and I think a lot about New Orleans these days, and especially about the Gulf of Mexico. It's a problem. It could be the end of the world, but that's another thing. We don't want to discuss that. And I think about the lyrics to some of these things, and this one has a pretty good verse. Bessie Smith, I think, wrote the words for this. She recorded it with Clarence Williams, who published it. Also, and he was a smart businessman, record the things that you have also published. Anyway, and she wrote some interesting things. I don't know if she wrote this stuff down, but one of the verses is like this. She said, "Some of you men sure do make me tired." And then, as is common practice in a 12-bar blues chorus, she repeated that line, "Some of you men really make me tired." And then she said, "You got a mouthful of gimme." No, I can see I always do that backwards. I apologize. "Got a handful of gimme and a mouthful of much obliged." And so I think about New Orleans. Anyway, so it's the Gulf Coast Blues. Thank you. that was kind of an early boogie-woogie tune. It's by a guy named Pinetop Smith, who was an interesting guy. He didn't live very long and got in an accident. He was actually stopped in at the wrong dance hall on the way back from somewhere one afternoon. Somebody was having an argument, and he was standing in the wrong place. He got shot. Unfortunately, Pinetop made some recordings, though, just before that. He was from down south, but he came up to Chicago in hopes of getting work as a piano player, I guess, among other things, and recorded just a few things, but they were very influential, and he influenced just about everybody else. But he, in turn, like so many others, was influenced by the guy I was talking about before, and that was Jimmy Yancey. Yancey was, he really is my favorite. And I'm going to play something. I played this the other day, but I have to do it again because it's just so beautiful. Not necessarily my playing of it. I'm trying to copy him. That's something else again. And it's called Jimmy's Stuff. Did I mention the title of that piece, the last one? No. It's called Jump Steady Blues. Okay. Yeah, whatever jump steady means, there you go. Some people said it was a term for whiskey or something, I'm not sure. Does that sound right? Not familiar with whiskey myself. But anyway, why do you think that's funny? Anyway, but here's Jimmy's stuff. Say one more thing about the blues as long as we're talking. Some of you people, if you like music, probably know all this stuff already, but that's okay, I'm going to tell you anyway. Any big blues fans in here? Yeah, well, sure. Anyway, just to get some of the basics in, obviously it's vocal music, and as all music really strives to be, I think. Yeah. But the piano, if you think about it, is pretty limited when it comes to trying to sound like somebody's singing. We can't really get a vibrato, for example, unless you use some kind of a trick like a trill or something, and can't get a sustain unless you do something like that, some kind of a trill or shake or something. But the worst part of it is the pitch problem. And I don't mean the piano's out of tune, of course. It only has 88 notes on it, and you can't play anything in between there in the cracks. And so if you're going to try to play vocal music on the piano with something like the blues, which is so expressive, you need to figure out a way to give that illusion that you're able to play between the pitches and have that kind of sustain and vibrato and all that. And the early blues guys like Yancey, he didn't have any training or anything, so you say, okay, that's simple, that's just a trill or something. Yeah, but he had to figure it out for himself pretty much. As far as playing in the cracks is concerned, that's easy. You just, like, I can hit a black key and a white key, and then if I do it right, it can sound like you're sliding the pitch. Let's see if it works. Okay, there's your blues. All right. Now, one other thing about it, as, again, just the basics, but if it's vocal music, and of course, it's really folk music, as is every kind of music, I always say, but it started with people just kind of singing, and it somehow became this not exactly rigid at all. It's never rigid, but it's just the same formula all the time. Three lines, if you have the lyrics as well as the music. And I always use the example of St. Louis Blues by W.C. Handy, who was an African-American guy, became very successful because he was the first man to publish and try to actually publish an accurate rendering of blues style. We don't have time for his biography, but St. Louis Blues was one of its most successful numbers, and it was for a long time, it might still be, I don't know for sure, the most recorded blues number. Anyway, the first verse of that is, I hate to see the evening sun go down. And then as you're singing this, if you're extemporizing, as I'm sure these people who started this out were doing, you were extemporizing, you didn't know exactly how you're going to finish this thing, but it didn't matter because you get another shot at it. You have time then to stand back and think about what you just said. You say it again, I hate to see the evening sun go down. By then maybe you thought of something to say that rhymes. Makes me think I'm on my last go around. Simple, but you can just do so much with this. And I always say simplicity is the best thing. It's the foundation of everything else, no matter how complex. And it's a good illustration of it. I'm going to play a blues thing right now that I've been working on more recently. This was folk music too. All the piano players, a lot of them, had a version of this. And the blues guys, and they all wanted to have the best version, but it was the same tune. I got to know one of these characters fairly well. His name was Little Brother Montgomery. He was from Louisiana. He had lived in Mississippi, and he'd worked in both Mississippi and Louisiana, but he ended up in Chicago, and I met him there in the 70s. Got to know him pretty well. Then he came to my house for a weekend in Minneapolis, and we'd sit down. He would sit down and play the piano. I would try to imitate some of the stuff he was doing, which I'll say more about in a minute. But he talked about this tune. He said they all called it the 44s. His version of it was the Vicksburg Blues, and that was because he had some lyrics about Vicksburg, Mississippi. I can't play it exactly like him, but just to give you some ideas, it sounds a little different from some of these other pieces I've been playing. Thank you.
much.
He was trying to teach me how to play some of this stuff, and I'm sitting next to him on the piano bench, and he, this little sliding thing he does in the left hand, I figured out a way to play it, and it sounds like this. I thought, okay, you can do that. Just slide your fingers off the black keys onto the white keys, nothing to it. And so that's what I was doing. I had my hand in the proper hand position. And I've been taking piano lessons for a while by that time. And it sounded kind of like, exactly to me, like it did when he was playing it. He said, no, you can't do it like that. That don't sound right, you know. And he had this strange, unorthodox way of, he wanted me to put my hand down under the keyboard, here are the keys, and somehow roll the whole thing with my wrist. I could not figure this out. That is what he was doing. To me, it sounded the same, but I guess that the way to do it was just as important as the sound to him or something. One other thing about Little Brother, think about some of the early blues players, and if you guys like early blues, you'll know this. Some of them, the standard length for one of these choruses, about, like, such as, I hate to see the evening sun go down, to a certain number of beats, 12 measures, 12 bar blues divided in three parts with the lyrics, two 4-bar things that are alike, at least the lyrics are, and then the answer is another 4-bar, and that's 12, but, you know, why, if you're a soloist, would you have to stick to that? And some of the early guys didn't. Little Brother was kind of a stickler for that. And you know, some of his best friends for some of these other players, one of his best friends was the great Roosevelt Sykes, another blues player. But Roosevelt would often add an extra measure here and take one out there when he was playing the blues. So Little Brother was careful to distinguish himself from a person like that who would do such a thing. And he called him a time breaker. And he said, he's a time breaker. Nice boy, but he's a time breaker. And this, in the course of getting to know him, this occurred to me that he kind of defined a lot of his life this way, time breakers versus guys like him who could keep time or something. And I'm just telling you this because I think it's kind of interesting psychology. That he even started talking about presidents of the United States, like Harry Truman. He played a little piano, and he was not a time breaker. Then he said, okay, Richard Nixon, not a time breaker. Now, this was starting to push things a little too far, you know. Anyway, great musician, and it's nice that he looked at the world through his musical eye that way, I thought. Okay, that was kind of getting off the track. To get back to some of the main themes here. And I think what I was meant to do is, if I'm not mistaken, or even if I am mistaken, is go into, okay, we're going to go from this into some of the New Orleans music that I was talking about in the first class, Jelly Roll Morton. He had a... It sounds kind of like ragtime, his music. One of the big differences is that you improvise. You play variations on things. You never play anything the same way twice. And why would you want to? Because the originality of each performance is part of the thing. And so I thought this will sound to you like ragtime, probably in a certain way. It might be a little bit different kind of swing to it, but. It's a tune called The Pearls, and it has that timekeeping left hand, and you play against that with the right, so it's the same thing. Jelly Roll Morton, and it's called The Pearls. past the Pearls, and I never played it the same way twice either, but I'm not anywhere near on his level, but I just don't remember what I did. So that's it. And I kind of shortened that because I don't want to run out of time here. He plays more variations, and of course, somebody like that could go on for hours with that kind of thing. That's New Orleans. Jelly Roll Morton was from there, and he was much more than a great pianist. He was a great band leader, composer, pool player as well. Some even more nefarious activities than that. Well, music's bad enough. Anyway, see, I don't want to miss any of the points that I meant to hit, so I think I'll just keep moving here. I want to encourage everybody, there's a video that we're showing tomorrow night, and it's a documentary on the great New Orleans-born singer Mahalia Jackson, who a lot of you probably know about. And she was born down there in 1911, and she only lived to be 61, 62 years old, but her accomplishments were manifold, and this is a documentary, this thing. It's even if you don't think you can stay till the end of it, you want to go to bed early or something, you should come because you at least get a taste of what her performances were like. It's about a tour that she went on, a European tour, and they filmed it, and this was not long before she died, around 1970. So you see her on all these great big concert stages and outdoor festival stages, and the audience is absolutely going out of their minds. And I want to play a track by Mahalia right now, and you'll hear that this music has a lot in common with everything we've been talking about. And this track, I think, is from I know because I got it written down, but pretty sure it's 1961. And she was in Sweden with just her piano player, Mildred Falls. And I think this is, when we do it, it's track two. And it's down by the riverside, which I have a radio show in on a tiny independent public station in Minneapolis, and I play this every once in a while because I wish people would listen to the message. 1961, April 18th in Sweden, and it's just two people, Mahalia Jackson and her piano player, Mildred Falls. And some friends of mine heard her in 1958 at the St. Paul Auditorium. Again, just Mildred and the great singer, and they said it was absolutely, they never heard anything like it, changed their lives. That's hard to get from a recording, but you get some idea. And you could think about as well what this has in common, the music itself, with what we've been doing here, ragtime and all that stuff about the blues and singing and trying to vocalize on the piano. She didn't have to do it on the piano. She had one of the greatest voices that there ever was. So here it is, Down by the Riverside, 1961.
Study, we'll walk no more.
Recording doesn't really tell the story, but this film really brings it to life, so you should come. Like I said, even if you can't stand to stay till the end, you should at least come for part of it. Nobody's going to get mad if you leave. It's at 8:30, and if you did stay till the end, you'd still be up at 10 o'clock. Yeah, that's not too bad. That could be a lot worse. One of the things I'm also featuring in this series of sessions, what I like to call them classes, is you know, the commonalities between all these, what are supposedly different kinds of music, African-American music, and another one is jazz, of course, and the Louis Armstrong. So there's a tune called When the Saints Go Marching In. It's an old spiritual, and the assumption is always that if you think about it at all, if it matters to you, if you think about that, you think, okay, this goes right back to the very beginning of the New Orleans jazz tradition, that it was played for funeral parades and things, and it's always been a standard part of the repertoire. But in fact, I don't think so. I don't think it was that popular until after Louis Armstrong recorded it, which is later than you might think. See, I have to look at, I should have had this in my hand, you know, but I don't have a director for this show, so. We have some directors, but they're not this kind. All right, maybe I should have asked him to do. Oh well. All right, Paul? No. Yeah, 1938 in New York. 1938. By that time, Armstrong had been away from New Orleans for a long time, and he never did go back home after he left there in 1921. So he'd been away for quite a while. And he's in New York here, and he was at the getting really close to the top of the entertainment business by that time, too. And, May 13th, 1938. And he'd been appearing in New York fairly regularly, but widely traveled as well. But the first time in New York was 9 years earlier, and that's when he made his breakthrough into show business. So by this time, he was becoming just like an African-American entertainer with a big fan base of African-Americans, but he was starting to spread out as a great entertainer, too. Anyway, When the Saints Go Marching In, recorded with a band led by one of his fellow New Orleanians who didn't get much billing on the record, but that was Louis Russell. And here it is, When the Saints Go Marching In. This is the record that people in New Orleans started listening to and started basing their playing of this on this recording. I think a lot of them did. You can hear it in what they played. Louis Armstrong.
Sisters and brothers, this is Reverend Satchmo getting ready to beat out this mellow sermon for you. My text this evening is When the Saints Go Marching In. Here come Brother Hickenbottom down the aisle with his trombone. Blow it, boy.
Yeah. when the saints,
when the saints
go marching in,
marching in.
Now when the saints go marching in,
marching in.
Yes, I want to be in that number when the saints go marching in.
Do it, Brother Holmes.
Go marching in,
marching in.
When the saints go marching in,
marching in.
Yes, I want to be in that number when the saints go marching in.
Couple more things by two other pianists from the East Coast whom I didn't get time to mention. If you have the patience for that, I wonder. Okay. Sometimes I'm not sure. one of them is I did mention James P. Johnson. I just didn't get to illustrate all the facets of his playing the way I wanted to. And if you were here, you'd heard me play the Charleston, which was the last thing in the concert or the class. Sorry, misspoke. And I just wanted to play something else because he not only could he play fast and play lots of notes, but he also wrote some beautiful kind of lyrical pieces. And here's one of them.
Thank you.
very quickly, I'll finish up with a couple of tunes by the great Fats Waller, who was actually a protege of this man here, James P. Johnson. But Fats Waller became really famous as a consummate entertainer. He was just as big as Louis Armstrong, but didn't live long enough. Big, but of course he was also big. That's why he was Fats Waller, but anyway. He was everywhere. He was in the movies, and he had records that were really selling. They were in every jukebox in the country, and hundreds and hundreds of sides with a little band he had called Fats Waller and his Rhythm, and he was recording for the Victor label, which was a pretty big deal, lots of distribution. He was extremely funny, and he could sit there and play all this wonderful piano and look like he wasn't doing anything. You look at these old videos, he's got all this stuff going, but it kind of looks like, oh, just put your hands down there, set that one over there. All this stuff is coming out. You can find him on YouTube, as you can just about anybody I mentioned here. Lots of Fats Waller stuff on YouTube, if you're curious about what the real thing looks like. So I'll just play a couple of his things here. The first one is kind of programmatic, and it's called Clothesline Ballet. Self-explanatory. Except that, you know, some places now you're not supposed to have a clothesline or zoning against it, which that's kind of ridiculous. I have a really nice clothesline. It's beautiful. It's wonderful. My friend Gaylord Chanelik built it. I can't even explain it. Why am I even mentioning it? If you think about the clothes waving on the line, you know, that's what he was. That's what the music was about. I might do a little medley. I'll play that, and then a little bit of Ain't Misbehavin', which is probably his most famous tune, and then something else at the end.
Thank you. you very much.
Thanks a lot. That's it for today. And it's sorry I kept you so long. If you have the chance, please come to the video tomorrow night. And like I say, I'll be happy to excuse you early. But you should at least see part of it. Thank you very much.